Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on February 9th, 2019. This is the fifth week of our Saturday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is a third of a series of talks on the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. This is the third talk on the second week or the second chapter on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. I think we'll finish it today. We started out with looking at and integrating Shamatha Vipassana meditation, why the Buddha taught that singular meditation method, the purpose of it for deepening concentration to support insight into the three marks of existence that is itself developed through integration of the Eightfold Path. And the instructions that I give during our meditation, the guidance to notice the arising and passing away of feelings and thoughts and come back to the sensation of breathing, that relates to the first three foundations of mindfulness. And that instruction at the end, notice the quality of your mind, be at peace with your mind, that relates to the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And that leads directly to what I'm going to start with today. The Buddha taught in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the beginning portion, the four foundations of mindfulness. Be mindful of the breath and the body to begin our meditation. Be mindful of feelings and thoughts arising and passing away. And that's it. That's all we do with feelings and thoughts. We don't interpret them. We don't label them. We don't analyze them in any way. Because if you remember that the purpose of meditation is to deepen concentration, once we get into labeling or analysis or any other method of meditation, such as deity worship or focusing on a flower or a candle, we're not deepening our concentration by being mindful of the breath and the body. Being mindful of the breath and the body isn't, there's nothing magical or mystical, or maybe I should even say supernatural or extraordinary about being mindful of your breath, except when you are actually mindful of your breath, in that moment you have united your mind and your body, which is the whole point of the Buddha's teaching, to not be distracted by external thoughts, events, views, and ideas. So John, this, yes.
I know we haven't started yet, but just then when I was meditating.
What have I been doing if we haven't started?
Well, I know we haven't. And then when you said, whatever you say at the end, be mindful of your mind and whatever, it's like I came back to myself. It's like I kind of lost myself and I was just on my breathing.
Do you mean today or in
just
most
now,
okay.
Right now, just today. And I kind of like completely lost who I was, what I think I am, blah, 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 blah. And then, so is that really how we should try to be, not ourselves? Because I completely drifted away from who I thought I was, who I think I am, etc. And then when you said that, I kind of like, oh, you know, and then I came back to myself again, how I think of myself.
It just simply brought you back to what's occurring.
Yeah.
I'm not quite certain how to answer your question because I don't know the intention. So if your intention in meditation, even if it's this subtle decision that I'm meditating so I'm not myself, that's a distraction. And so even recognizing that, come back to the sensation of breathing. But in a meditation, while you were meditating, before you heard me say that, were you mindful of your breath?
Yes. That's all I was doing.
That's meditation.
I was just like a breathing machine. I was just like...
Oh, yeah.
I'd like lost myself and...
But that's because you were experiencing you were having the experience of being single-pointedly focused on your breath.
Yes.
And you were doing it during meditation.
Yes.
The reason why I say that is it's not a good idea to be doing that when you're driving a car.
No.
Well, but in meditation, that's exactly what you should be doing, and it's really what you should at least occasionally experience. And the reason why I say occasionally is it's not just that, is it? I don't know anybody that is able. I've been meditating for maybe 38 years now, and I still don't start meditation, become mindful of my breath, and 30 minutes later, I haven't had one other thought except my breath. That's just not true, and it's not my goal. I don't hope to ever get to that point, because that isn't the point. The point of meditation is to deepen concentration. I do that by being mindful of when I'm not concentrated, and come back to the sensation of breathing.
Got you.
Yeah. And again, maybe there are some meditators that can just become mindful of their breath. But honestly, I've never met one. I've never heard anybody talk about that who was a serious meditator. I've heard people brag about how long they meditate, 2 hours, 3 hours, 16 hours a day. But, that's kind of another topic. But an important point. Thank you for bringing that up. Okay, so the Buddha first teaches us the method, the four foundations of mindfulness. And then the rest of the Satipatthana Sutta is taught so that we understand how to apply that ever-deepening concentration and the refined mindfulness. In other words, the reason why I keep making that distinction is a lot of these other subjects are taught in modern Buddhist schools as subjects for meditation, meaning pick a hindrance, pick doubt, or craving sensual desire. And you're taught to meditate on that. Well, that's not deepening concentration, is it? So it's not meditation as far as what the Buddha's talking about. And technically, when we meditate on a subject and analyze it and pick it apart, deconstruct it, that's not meditation, is it? It's contemplation, and it won't deepen concentration. It's not a bad idea to use a mind that has developed a measure of concentration to sit quietly and think about a subject, but that's not meditation. And that's an important topic. And then some of the other things that the Buddha touches in here, particularly the seven factors of awakening, those are often taken out of context as one particular subject. And again, let's meditate on compassion or selflessness. The Buddha didn't teach those types of things, again, because I can't sit and contemplate how to become more compassionate without reinforcing the fact that I'm becoming more compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
And do you see the contradiction between what the Buddha is hoping to teach and what we're hoping to develop? The diminishing of I-making, and really the diminishing that I'm doing anything extraordinary except awakening. And so that self-reference to, or creating a doctrine that is easily self-referenced or feeds self-identification, is a contradiction. The Buddha begins this section of the Satipatthana Sutta now to teach us how do you apply this well-concentrated mind supporting refined mindfulness. In relation to the five hindrances, remain mindful of the quality of mind in reference to the five hindrances. It's a simple, easy direction, isn't it? But why does the Buddha have to give such simple and basic instructions, and why do we still need them 2,600 years later? Because we're prone to distraction. We'll take things like one or all of these hindrances and create a whole new spiritual study on them. Rather than what the Buddha said, remain mindful of the quality of mind in reference to the five hindrances. What does that mean? It means that I notice that the quality of my mind is agitated because I'm stuck in sensual desire about, I hope somebody didn't finish the chocolate cake before I get home. I'm using a silly example, but do you see the distraction in my mind? Rather than be present, sitting here teaching a class, my mind is at home in the future looking in a refrigerator looking for chocolate cake. A silly example, but that's what our minds do. Remain mindful of the quality of mind in reference to the five hindrances. When sensual desire is present, be mindful that sensual desire is present. Again, no analysis, no labeling, no anything. Recognize that I am distracted right in this moment by the need for constant sensory indulgence. When it's present, be mindful of it, period. And then what do? Once I realize that I'm caught up in sensual desire, what's the next step in meditation?
Go back to your breath.
Back to your breath. When sensual desire is not present, be mindful that sensual desire is not present. So important. The Buddha spent nearly as much time teaching what we should be mindful of as he did to teach what we shouldn't be mindful of, what we should recognize and abandon. And that's an important aspect of developing concentration. Not just, okay, I'm only going to be mindful of my breath. To be mindful of these different qualities of mind to recognize the distraction in them. In other words, we can insist that I never have any type of agitation in my mind, and we can also insist that I never want to be distracted by anything pleasurable. This subtle difference is simply to recognize that you're distracted by the need for sensory indulgence and come back to the sensation of breathing. Be mindful that when sensual desire has been completely abandoned, sensual desire will not arise in the future. Excuse me. It's a guarantee that the Buddha is offering that once we develop this quality of mind to a certain point, we won't have to deal with it ever again. Does anybody, or does everyone believe that it is possible to get to the point to let go of all sensual desire so that it doesn't arise again?
No.
Even though a Buddha says it?
I can't imagine me ever getting there.
Okay, let me ask the question. Well, it's not in a different way. It's a different question. Have you all felt a diminishment of grasping after sensual desire when it arises?
Yes.
All of you? Okay. Yeah. Say yes, please.
Yes.
Okay, so I can't see you shaking your head. So the reason why I say that is to point out that even though you haven't reached the goal, you're developing it. And that's what the Buddha's pointing out. It's important to recognize that this is working, to recognize when it's not present too. Mm-hmm. Just as important. Because that can also, it encourages our Dhamma practice, but also reinforces what otherwise might be grasping after our Dhamma practice. Oh, I'm not there yet. I got so much, I'm overwhelmed with how much further there is to go.
Yeah.
It's working.
Yeah.
In the moment, notice that it's working. Notice how much beneficial, we talk so much about this, how much beneficial our lives are, how much more beneficial our lives are, simply by taking up this practice. That's what the Buddha's teaching. Notice it. When ill will is present, be mindful that ill will is present. When ill will is not present, be mindful that ill will is not present. Be mindful of abandoning ill will when it arises. So these are all things that we do with our mind, with our mindfulness, with our concentration. Instead of justifying, usually when we become frustrated or angry at someone, our next thought is usually a thought of justification, why it's right to think this way about someone else. Or when we're feeling ill will about ourselves. We hardly ever notice how we jump on our own bandwagon and usually beat the heck out of ourselves. And we justify it by going back and rehashing behavior or something that we should have done, rather than simply be present with what's occurring right now, which, and in the moment, with a mind that's united with its body, there can be no ill will towards oneself or others. It's just not possible. But when we notice when ill will is present, we can also acknowledge that we're now out of our body. We're, in a sense, acting in a mindless way. And again, don't go to the justification, well, that guy shouldn't have done that, or etc. It's what's occurring in my mind right now. And if I'm stuck on what someone did to me or what I might do in the future, I've lost my mind, haven't I? As far as the Dhamma is concerned, I'm no longer here with what's occurring. When ill will is not present, be mindful that ill will is not present. Be mindful of abandoning ill will when it arises. Be mindful that when ill will has been completely abandoned, ill will not arise in the future. Again, the Buddha offers those guarantees for each one of these hindrances. When laziness and drowsiness is present, be mindful that laziness and drowsiness is present. When laziness and drowsiness is not present, be mindful that laziness and drowsiness is not present. Be mindful of abandoning laziness and drowsiness when it arises. So again, we don't do anything with it. We don't try to figure it out. But when we don't feel like meditating and it's our time to meditate and we feel like just watching whatever we're watching on TV or playing with or whatever we might be doing, recognize that this is simply laziness. It's a hindrance to my Dhamma practice, and the best way to overcome it is to sit and meditate. In fact, I would say the best time to meditate is when you don't feel like meditating. Always. Unless you're driving. Be mindful that when laziness and drowsiness has been completely abandoned, laziness and drowsiness will not arise in the future. What a wonderful promise to hold in mind, isn't it? If we've truly taken refuge, the Ratana Sutta, in the Buddha, his Dhamma, and a well-focused Sangha, we know that we can get there. Because an awakened human being showed us, and he didn't just say we can do it, he showed us with his own life, and he taught us this simple path to do this ourselves. When restlessness and anxiety is present, be mindful that restlessness and anxiety is present. When restlessness and anxiety is not present, be mindful that restlessness and anxiety is not present. Be mindful of abandoning restlessness and anxiety when it arises. Be mindful that when restlessness and anxiety has been completely abandoned, restlessness and anxiety will not arise in the future. Again, the same guarantee. When doubt and uncertainty is present, be mindful that doubt and uncertainty is present. When doubt and uncertainty is not present, be mindful that doubt and uncertainty is not present. Be mindful of abandoning doubt and uncertainty when it arises. Be mindful that when doubt and uncertainty has been completely abandoned, doubt and uncertainty will not arise in the future. We were talking earlier about that. That's a big one, doubt and uncertainty. At some point, we're going to doubt what we're doing in relation to our Dhamma practice. We'll doubt the Dhamma. This can't be true. How could you know something 2,600 years later? Whatever your mind might come up with. That's why it's so important to recognize that it's working. So when doubt and uncertainty arise, we already know that, yes, this is working, and this is where my mind is right now. It's stuck in doubt and uncertainty, but in my next breath, I can recommit. This is an aspect of right effort, recommit to the Dhamma practice. Why? Because I know it works. It's not because some old fool on Saturday morning tells you to try it out. We've had the experience of it. Again, there's so much... the Buddha repeats himself often on that one theme to recognize that it's working. Because it's the one thing that he recognized about the other spiritual systems that they weren't working, but they provided a great distraction. So people keep doing it.
I mean, John, I always find it hard to be aware that you're not having a feeling. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that a feeling isn't present. Thank you. Yeah. It's such an important... So how do you conjure it up? Mm. From a well-concentrated mind that has gone through the process of, I'll just use doubt, of being distracted by doubt and has worked on it within this Eightfold Path and has diminished or eliminated doubt, at that point you will recognize, hey, I'm not full of doubt anymore. It's just there. Because a quality of your mind that used to afflict you in some way is no longer present. Because you've done the work. It's not magic. There's nothing mystical or extraordinary, except that this works, about this. And we've done the work ourselves. So now that I'll put you on the spot, some of the things that used to concern you in the past, I would bet you realize no longer do they?
Sometimes they don't, sometimes they do.
Yeah.
John, I'm on a roller coaster.
Yeah, and it's often like that too for many people. You know, I used to call this a period of undoing. And so I will, because it works. During this period of undoing, it often feels like we're a rubber band bouncing back and forth between behaviors. And again, this relates directly to that, doesn't it? When the Buddha says, when you're caught up in a certain hurtful behavior, recognize it and come back to your breath. Recognize it as present, that's all. And also when you recognize, I'm not as in much doubt as I used to be. I'm much less anxious. Recognize that and go through your day holding that in mind. It's so important. You know, it's again one of those things that I remember early on when I started actually practicing what the Buddha taught, and quickly how the benefits started building up that I could not recognize them, but recognize them was such an important part of engaging in this Eightfold Path wholeheartedly. Because it was working. And for the first time in my life, I was actually feeling a benefit of my so-called Buddhist practice. Mm-hmm. So again, it's so important.
Just to say, that path of undoing, that, oh my goodness, what a great way of looking at it. It really is.
I stole it from a biography of Helen Schuckman, who wrote The Course in Miracles. So. But it really is that. We really are undoing our conditioned mind. And it is... layer by layer, you know, using skin as a metaphor. It takes time, and we have, unless you're Kundana and a few others that woke up pretty quickly with the Dhamma, it's just like that. And so this is why I structured the classes like this. We basically cover the same material time after time after time, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is what it takes. It really is this basic. There's nothing extraordinary. The Dhamma is about what's happening right now in our minds. But because our minds are so distracted, the Buddha came up with all these different themes, different ways of looking at basically the same thing. Of a mind rooted in ignorance will create any type of self-referential experience to ignore its own ignorance. That's the problem of ignorance.
Yeah.
And here, these are all... So, in many ways, getting back to this, doubt is a perfect vehicle for ignorance to continue to ignore its own ignorance, isn't it? Because we tend to give in to doubt and uncertainty. We run away from it. Mm-hmm. And again, there's a whole school of modern Buddhism that tells us to cultivate doubt. The Buddha says recognize doubt for what it is. It's a hindrance to your practice, and get past it. It's just there. It's not anything to figure out. It's doubt. Get past it. Come back to your Dhamma practice. The same with all these other hindrances. That's the way treating anything with mindfulness. In this way, mindfulness always means, when it's framed by the Eightfold Path, it's always a dispassionate, selfless way of looking at the world. And the reason why I make that qualification, a lot of modern mindfulness actually encourages conceit and eye-making, but that's not today's talk. In this way, one remains mindful of the Buddha's concluding now, being mindful of the five hindrances. In this way, one remains mindful of the quality of mind and the arising and the passing away of qualities of mind, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. In other words, this process that our mind is going through, even though due to clinging self-referential thoughts, it feels like our minds and our thoughts are attached to everything around us. The truth of the matter is, none of that is actually occurring except in our own mind because of clinging. These are just thoughts flowing. The clinging self-referential thoughts that give rise to doubt have no real foundation. They're like, as the term the Buddha would use, it's like foam on the water. There's no real substance there except the substance that we give it by self-referencing, self-identifying with our thoughts. Which is every thought that we have from a mind that's rooted in ignorance that has informed itself through a fabricated view sees every thought as itself. Every thought is a self-referential thought. And so because of that, we have a very difficult time letting it go because it's mine, it's me. This whole idea of who I am is rooted in a fabrication to be recognized and abandoned. What's left when we let go of all those self-referential views? A calm and peaceful mind that is able to be, to live a meaningful life simply because it's present for that life for the first time. And then every moment is meaningful. Why? Because simply because I'm here, I'm living it. It doesn't take something extraordinary or or self-referential to now get me involved in my life. I'm involved in my life because I'm involved in my life. There's no qualification or condition on it. It's another what Kandana meant when he awakened, but I won't get into it. Independent of and not clinging to anything in this world. This is how one remains mindful of the quality of mind in and of itself. Independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. It's another perfect example of mindfulness. I'm going to skip over some comments. The next section here is mindfulness of the five clinging aggregates. But again, notice the Buddha's teaching us what we should be developing as part of our Dhamma practice too. In other words, mindfulness of the hindrances allows us to control them, doesn't it? To not just give in to doubt and uncertainty or laziness. To recognize this is what's occurring. Now that I have control of my mind, I don't have to be lazy anymore. I can go and sit when a part of me is saying, you don't have time to sit, or you don't want to bother with it today, or it's too cold or too, whatever it might be. You have control of your mind. When you feel like you're doubtful about a task you might have that seems overwhelming, you'll recognize, well, that's not occurring right now. And all I have to do is go do something. Mm-hmm. Now he's applying the same type of concentration and mindfulness now that we've developed in meditation to the five clinging aggregates. Furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in reference to the five clinging aggregates. Remain mindful of form and the arising and passing away of form. Does anybody not understand what that means? It's pretty simple, isn't it? Be mindful of the arising and passing away of physical form. This form that I've self-identified as me, but all forms, everything is impermanent. That's the basic, profound teaching that the Buddha awakened to. Everything is impermanent. But when we attach ourselves through wrong views to that which is impermanent and try to make it permanent because I've self-identified with it, we've now become lost in our own views, haven't we? Because we can't make anything permanent, especially me. Remain mindful of feelings and the arising and passing away of feelings. And notice how this relates directly to the foundations of mindfulness. To be mindful of arising and passing away of feelings. And stop identifying myself and myself to the world through how I feel. Because it's temporary. Why would I want to attach myself and define and describe my life by how I feel? Did everybody see how hurtful that type of thinking is? To insist that I'm going to describe my life by how I feel, when I know that my feelings are constantly changing. And when my mind is not controlled, my feelings are constantly changing by things that I'm out of control to manage. So I'm lost, aren't I? Until I gain control of my thinking through this meditation method, and then when a feeling arises, it's just a feeling. It doesn't mean that I don't have any feeling. Notice that that's an important point to be made too. Because at first glance to some, this might seem like we're becoming robots, that we don't feel at all. It simply means we don't need to change how we feel, which means we're able to be mindfully present with our life as our life occurs. We're not missing anything. We're simply here and present for it. Remain mindful of perceptions and the arising and passing away of perceptions. Again, very simple and direct. The way that I'm perceiving this moment is impermanent too, and that can change. And I can change my perceptions and mold them in a certain way to continue to guide me towards awakening if I'm using an Eightfold Path to do just that. And it's kind of the point of the Dhamma. Remain mindful of consciousness and the arising and passing away of consciousness. It's so important. Even though I have all these things that I've decided are me and mine in relation to the world, and the world is a certain way, and people are a certain way, and politicians are a certain way, and cars drive a certain, it doesn't matter. I've created conditions on myself, and they're all temporary, and they all can change. And as Lao Tzu said, once you recognize the impermanence of all things, you'll let go of everything. But most importantly, you'll let go of your need to be anything different than who you are. Because the only time that can change is right here and right now. No matter what I've done in the past, or what I think I might do in the future, the only change, the only substantive change I can make is right here. In fact, I wouldn't say substantive. The only change period I can make is in this present moment. It's another reason why merit-based spiritual systems were so aberrant to the Buddha, because it took him out of right now. Almost every religion teaches you do something good now, you're going to get something good in the future. The Buddha didn't teach anything like that. It's really the most radical part of his teaching is that he taught it's not about what we're going to get, it's about who we are. And that's still, as far as I know, there's no other philosophical or spiritual teaching that teaches just that in a way to achieve that. Krishnamurti used to say the same thing, but he didn't understand that most human beings, he was so brilliant that he was beyond an Eightfold Path, I think, but he did not understand that other people aren't. That's really the brilliance of the Buddha. Because as far as I know, and I put a lot of time into this, he's the only one that taught a path to get to what he thought human beings should be, a taught to get to our true potential, truly awaken. Okay. Wanted to finish this today, but I might not. In this way, one remains mindful of the five clinging aggregates and the arising and passing away of the five clinging aggregates, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. Again, it just means we're not clinging to the world or our views. This is how one remains mindful of the five clinging aggregates. So again, a clear teaching that the five clinging aggregates are the Buddha's description of the personal ongoing experience of suffering rooted in ignorance. So does everybody get that? Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. But it's ongoing consciousness in this sense is ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's the five clinging aggregates. Does everybody understand that? Mm-hmm. So even though they're unfamiliar terms, it simply describes me. It describes me in a confused and a state of ignorance of Four Noble Truths, five clinging aggregates. Right? Yes. So the significance then is to recognize that these five aggregates that I use to establish myself in the world are all impermanent.
Excuse me.
There's nothing there. And again, the Buddha's emphasizing not to analyze any of this. Simply be mindful of it. So when I'm feeling an emotional pain, I can also remind myself that it's because I'm taking something personal, that's occurring. And that is Mary described it earlier. You did too. That's being mindful in the right context of this is what's occurring. Why? Because when I stop taking it personal, ultimately I let go of all of those things that it shouldn't have happened, or I need more of it, and my mind is at peace. But also, as importantly, and it relates to what Mary said just a short while ago, I'm not conditioning my mind in that moment towards further ignorance because of a reaction. And it's in that moment, as Mary was describing, and Lorna too, when I'm recognizing behavior that in the past would cause me difficulties, I'm able to catch myself, or I'm at least able to recognize it now I'm acting in a way that is inappropriate to what I want to be in this world. Because you first have to understand that before you can stop anything, can you? You have to understand your own thinking if you're going to change your thinking. You can't distract yourself by some type of practice that doesn't allow you to recognize your own thinking and the resulting behavior, such as rituals and practices that do just that. You have to be in it. You have to unite your mind and your body if you're going to unite your mind and your body. You got to be in it to do it. I didn't mean to be so cute with that, but that's the essence of what the Buddha is teaching. That's the essence of this type of mindfulness. I'm going to skip ahead because now he goes through all the senses. Remain mindful of the eye form and the clinging that arises from the eye form and the nose form and the body form, the feeling form, the hearing form, etc. Right? It all says the same thing. You don't mind if I skip ahead? Probably grateful. I would be too. Remain mindful of the nose form, etc., etc. And as we do that through the five physical senses and that sixth sense of thinking, consciousness rooted in ignorance of or Four Noble Truths, being mindful of these different aggregates in a dispassionate, impersonal way, in this way one remains mindful of the sixth sense base and the arising and passing away of the sixth sense base, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the sixth sense base in and of themselves. So by simply being mindful that I am distracted by a smell or something that's caught my eye, or a beautiful sound, whatever it might be, or a loud noise that's impacting my meditation practice, simply be mindful of it. Again, we don't have to do anything. There's no great magic to understanding who we are either. In fact, if we're looking for magic, we won't be able to get it. But the way to understand who and what we are is to be present for who and what we are. When we hear something, we're just hearing it. As the Buddha said to Bahia in that great sutta, how do you say it? When for you there is not, when for you there is nothing, there's no you here, there, or anywhere else, then Bahia, you are awakened. Meaning you're not establishing yourself through your senses, you're simply using your senses as they are meant to be, to interact with the world, to be present, but not to I make. Mindfulness of the seven factors of awakening. So these seven factors are, you could see them as almost individual themes to be developed. Furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in reference to the seven factors of awakening. Remain mindful that mindfulness is a factor of awakening within me. Remain mindful. A practice is based on mindfulness. We should be mindful that mindfulness is a factor of it. But what the Buddha is really saying is be mindful that refined mindfulness is a factor of mindfulness. And that refined mindfulness is framed by the Eightfold Path, not in any other way. In other words, a lot of modern practices and modern mindfulness practices teach basically that mindfulness means that we should be thinking about whatever we're doing, and we should.
Excuse me.
In other words, when I'm washing dishes, I should be mindful of washing dishes and not thinking about something else. Whatever it might be, that's what we should be doing. But that's a result of a properly integrated Eightfold Path. It's not. In other words, we can't start our practice by, I have a completely distracted mind, but my practice is going to be mindful of washing dishes, and that's going to do something for me. Why? Because our minds are naturally too distracted to do that. You might even achieve some kind of mastery over washing the dishes, but so what? You haven't changed anything. In meditation, we learn to deepen our concentration through the four foundations of mindfulness. And then the Buddha doesn't leave us there. He tells us how to apply it. To see things from the relationship of the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. So when washing the dishes, I am naturally present with washing the dishes because it's a consequence of who I am now. It's not, it hasn't become a Dhamma practice itself.
Yeah.
And there's no tension there either. You're just washing the dishes. And probably not feeling bad that you got a whole stack of dishes. That hasn't happened to me yet, though. I haven't regained that part of my mind. If mindfulness as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that mindfulness as a factor of awakening is not present. Again, that reiteration that be mindful of the quality of your mind. If mindfulness, if peace isn't here, just be mindful of it. Don't do anything about it. Be mindful of what's occurring. And be mindful of how mindfulness as a factor of awakening will arise, meaning through appropriate mindfulness. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of mindfulness as a factor of awakening. In other words, we have to, just as the Buddha was teaching Sariputta how to deepen jhana, deepen concentration, we deepen our mindfulness by engaging with the Eightfold Path. Remain mindful that investigation of the Dhamma is a factor of awakening. Again, we have to do more than just meditating. This is something that the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago, and it's still ignored. And most of modern Buddhism treats meditation either as a pleasant anachronism or something you don't even need at all. And then some overdo it, too. Remain mindful that investigation of the Dhamma is a factor of awakening. If investigation of the Dhamma as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful so that we can actually investigate the Dhamma. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of investigation of the Dhamma as a factor of awakening. Just to be mindful that along the way, it's not just meditation. It's part of being a part of a well-focused Sangha. It's reading more about this. But most importantly, it's about recognizing that we're integrating this Eightfold Path into our lives. Remain mindful that persistence is a factor of awakening. If persistence as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that it's not present and continue. Again, we just have to keep going. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of persistence as a factor of awakening. Remain mindful that joyful engagement with the Dhamma is a factor of awakening. And that's something that we should really be mindful of. This is not something that, and I think most of us get over this pretty quickly, but this is not something we should be doing grudgingly or that we feel like we have to do it. Or somebody's imposing on, you know, that crazy old guy is telling me I have to do it. We do it because we're going to awaken. To me, this is, and I mean, I sincerely feel this way. These are the most remarkable, incredible teachings I've ever come across. And I feel very grateful that they're still here. And that and it's not that I have any special kind of mind, that I have a mind that can understand this. I can integrate this. I can actually use it. That's remarkable. That's enough to develop some joy in my life. If joyful engagement with the Dhamma as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that it's not. I'm going to skip ahead again. Remain mindful of the culmination of the development of joyful engagement with the Dhamma as a factor of awakening. So if we're not feeling terribly joyful about our Dhamma, look at it and generate it. It's really just an internal switch that we turn on in our own minds. Remain mindful that serenity is a factor of awakening. Excuse me. If serenity as a factor of awakening is not present, be mindful that serenity is not present and be mindful of how serenity as a factor of awakening will arise. So if we're not feeling terribly serene, what should we do if it's not present?
Be mindful that it's not present.
Yeah. Recognize it and recognize it.
Simple answer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because the Buddha didn't waste a word, and I'm sure he put this in. He included this in his teachings for a very specific reason, because he saw people probably early in practice that were struggling and saying, because I'm struggling, it must not be for me. Let me go try what this guy's doing. Rather than recognizing that that is something that is coming from within me, it's the reason why the Ratana Sutta is so important, and to just continue. He's offering great encouragement because he understands that every one of us as a human being is going to go through these different feelings at different times. And sometimes the Dhamma is going to seem just the most wonderful thing in the world. And there'll be at other times where we're really dragging ourselves to do it. Both are fine. Just keep doing it. And this simple admonition to be mindful that when serenity is present and when it's not is so important, isn't it? Because again, what do? I notice that my mind is not serene, and maybe I might think for the last 3 days I feel like it's really been missing. What should I do? What I should do is, if I can do it right then, is to meditate and look at something. You know, we had a whole website with hundreds and hundreds of articles and talks. Go on the website and find something that might give you some insight into why you're feeling that way. That's how we use the Dhamma, when serenity is not present. Remain mindful that concentration is a factor of awakening. If concentration as a factor of awakening is not present, simply be mindful of it and continue with the Dhamma practice. Again, I'm going to skip over. Remain mindful that equanimity is a factor of awakening. If equanimity or calm and peaceful mind is not present, be mindful that equanimity is not present. And be mindful of how equanimity as a factor of awakening will arise. Continue through Dhamma practice. In this way, one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening and the arising and the passing away of the seven factors of awakening, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening. I'm sure you can't recite what those seven factors are, but I'm going to ask you to go back and put a little well-concentrated mindfulness on remembering what these seven factors are and then noticing it in your Dhamma practice. It's very important. This isn't the only place where the Buddha teaches these factors of awakening. And the reason why they're important is that when we know what these seven factors are, we can specifically develop them. Okay, so now the Buddha taught us to develop concentration through the four foundations of mindfulness and then apply that mindfulness to the hindrances, to the five clinging aggregates, to the seven factors of awakening, and now to mindfulness of the Four Noble Truths themselves. And again, notice nowhere in here except the beginning is the Buddha teaching us to do any other meditation method with any of these topics. Right? Furthermore, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in reference to the Four Noble Truths. Remain mindful of knowing that this is stress, this is the origination of stress, this is the cessation of stress, and this is the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of stress. That references the Four Noble Truths, doesn't it? So the Buddha is saying that the ultimate culmination of mindfulness is to be fully mindful and understand the Four Noble Truths. When the Buddha describes an awakened human being from the point of view of right view, he says that this view has a profound and penetrative understanding of stress, the First Noble Truth. They understand and have abandoned the origination and the continuation of stress, craving and clinging. They've had the actual experience of the cessation of stress, and they've developed that cessation through the Eightfold Path. This is, again, the Buddha's only instruction for developing any path. It's right here. The Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of stress or suffering. In this way, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in and of itself. Another important line I keep referencing back to that line. In and of itself means simply the way it is. Not with any self-referential need that my mind be any different. Meaning I should be always following my bliss. I should always have this positive attitude. Again, that's not part of what the Buddha taught. It's simply to be present and aware of what's occurring without the need for it to be any different than it is. In this way, one remains mindful of the quality of mind in and of itself, internally and externally. One remains mindful of the phenomena of the origination of the qualities of mind and their arising and passing away. There is the knowledge of the maintenance of qualities of mind and their recollection, independent of and not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening in and of themselves. So by incorporating the Four Noble Truths, one remains mindful of the seven factors of awakening as a natural process of that. This last is called the effectiveness of the four foundations of mindfulness. These are guarantees the Buddha's offering. Now, if anyone develops these four foundations of mindfulness in this manner for 7 years, one could expect either complete understanding here and now, again, laying lie to the myth that awakening takes endless eons, which is how almost all the modern schools say, you can't really awaken, but keep going, and sometime in a zillion years you might get it. Right here and now. If there is any clinging and maintaining remaining in this present life, let alone 7 years, if anyone perfectly develops these four foundations of mindfulness in this manner for 6 or 5 or 4, or 3 or 2 or 1 year, for 6 months or 3 months, for 1 month, for 2 weeks, for 7 days, one could expect either complete understanding here and now, or if there is any clinging and maintaining remaining in this present lifetime. What an incredible amount of encouragement, isn't it? We can do it in this lifetime and maybe in the next week. So we'll see next Saturday how many of us have. The Buddha continues, friends, listen to how direct and look at how direct the emphasis the Buddha is placing on this Eightfold Path. Friends, this is a direct path for the purification of all beings, for the cessation of sorrow and regret, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for establishing the right method of practice, and for complete unbinding. In other words, these four foundations of mindfulness. That's the end of that sutta. Isn't it? I mean, the scope of what the Buddha covered in this sutta, the directness in what his meaning of refined mindfulness is. It's hard to understand how we could even think of getting confused outside of this, and yet most of us do. These are most every one of those other subjects that I touched on, people have made meditation practices out of it, and I've been in places that you are supposed to meditate on it. But the whole feeling of the sutta is lost, isn't it? When we're grasping after something else and understanding that in order to gain control of my mind, I use a meditation method that deepens concentration, and then I integrate as a framework for my life an Eightfold Path, and I'll gain what the Buddha just promised, and it works. And it is actually fairly simple and direct, isn't it? We'll go around the room. Let me start with Mary first, folks online. Mary, I'll unmute you, and I'll unmute David, too. How are you, Mary?
Hi, John. How's everybody?
I think everybody's good. Everybody's good?
Everybody's good. Hello, Mary.
Hi, Mary. This is an important sutta. I'm definitely going to do my homework and really take a look at the seven factors.
Good.
This is an opportunity to further develop your practice off your cushion, to see those parts of your life that are still not aligned not yet refined with the teachings. So very valuable, of course, to anybody, no matter where you are in your practice and what your hindrances are and what you're struggling with.
Yeah.
This is very valuable. So thank you, John.
Thank you, Mary. I'm glad you joined us today. Yeah, it is one of those key teachings you can't do without. David, how are you this morning?
Good morning.
Good morning.
The Buddha taught that wisdom removes ignorance.
Yep.
And because that wasn't enough, he had to flesh it out.
Yeah.
So through 84,000 suttas. But in the end, it really is, he's teaching you that greed, aversion, delusion can be overcome by the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
And that's the practice. And people should listen to your instruction about going back and reading the two main mindfulness suttas, because even though you shouldn't contemplate on it, it's good to understand and to recognize that something is present or something isn't present. And there's value in knowing, and you can say they're just lists, but it's really what you see arise and pass. So I think that was Jen was saying, sometimes you're not aware that something's not present, but knowing what these suttas are made up of will help you during your meditation and your off the cushion experience. So the Anapanasati Sutta was really important for me, because it just, even though it was, you can get caught up into contemplation of it, once you move past that, you just really understand that that's what's arising, and well, you should recognize it. So thank you for the teaching.
Thank you. Thank you, Derek, for joining us. Yeah, I'm going to conclude this study whenever we get to it with a couple of weeks on the Anapanasati Sutta. So, and it is just that. It when you look at it not as just a teaching on what to meditate on, but it's what to be aware of. That's all. And they're all basic themes of the Buddha's teaching. But it's more than just meditation. Glad you could join us, both of you. Lorna, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here. A while ago, I mentioned that I was using the very bottom on your website.
On Meta.
The Meta, which starts with the first line, that the first thing you meditate on is yourself.
Loving kindness. Yeah.
Yeah, loving kindness towards yourself. And I have used that recently as like a pre-warm-up to my meditation, my 30-minute meditation. And I think because of all, it can get lost in the teachings, but, and then get lost in the sight that you should be having loving kindness towards yourself.
Yeah.
And I think I've been using that meditation recently as a pre-warm-up, just to sort of refocus my attention that just on that. Because we can all be very, very hard on ourselves, you know, and expect things that you would never expect other people to do, but we expect us to, you know, always be right and true and straight and narrow and all that. So, well, nobody can live like that in reality, but, you know, we can all be hard on ourselves to when we don't accomplish that.
Yeah.
So I've been using that, so that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, yeah. Lorna's referring to a meditation that's on the website that I stopped using. I used to do it at every class, but maybe I'll resurrect it every now and then. And how important it is to let go, of any ill will towards myself if I'm going to develop this Dhamma. That's why I say it's so important to be very gentle with ourselves. Don't judge ourselves harshly. Just continue with this practice. Thank you. Matt, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you as well. Thanks for having me. With the sutta, it just struck me as interesting that how detailed the Buddha was in just all these, listing all these things and covering it. And it's almost like incredibly complex. It's just interesting, thousands of years ago, how many things are lined out. But at the same time, it's incredibly simple because it's really all saying exactly the same thing, which is when something arises, you know, acknowledge it without judgment, let it kind of keep riding like riding down a river. But it's just interesting juxtaposition to have those two so complex and so much detail yet like so simple and being one thing.
It really is remarkable, and I mean that a human being figured it out. You know, I mean, to me the essence of a brilliant mind is to see the simplicity in whatever it is that you're looking at. You know, and he figured it out where other people couldn't, and it works. Glad you're here. Mary, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here. I'm always amazed at how the Buddha, you know, he figured things out. He figured out how to word things that even 2,600 years later, they're totally applicable, and God knows the world has completely changed.
Yeah.
But human nature has not.
Yeah.
Basically. And I mean, he really figured it all out. It really is amazing.
And it is. And the world has changed. I mean, but the four truths are still true. And it's still the basic human problem everywhere. I mean, many people will, you know, especially when they first hear this, would say that's way too simplistic. But the human problem on this planet, and now, you know, out in the space, is ignorance. It's the cause of all the suffering in the world. Well, not all, because there's some that's inherent in, like, part of the environment, but, you know, we do a pretty good job. So,
but even things that happen in the environment, they happen, they're unpleasant. You know they're happening, it's an unpleasant feeling. Instead of fighting the feeling, just, you know, yeah, it's unpleasant.
Yeah.
Just acknowledge it.
It's just part of having a human life.
But you're taught a lot of times not to feel it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you shouldn't feel that. You should feel the way you feel.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And also based on, probably getting off field a little bit, based on the roles that we've taken on as individuals, men, women, different colors, those roles are given ways of being that we're supposed to be like too, aren't they? You know, as a man, well, you never cry and all that kind of, that's kind of what I'm referring to. Those are all just simply conditioned, acquired views, aren't they? When none of them have any relation to reality. It doesn't matter whether I'm strong or not. I mean, it really doesn't. It doesn't matter if I'm tall or short. It doesn't matter if I'm black or white. Nothing matters except that I say that it does. And so we create these incredible conflicts based on what? An ignorant view, no matter what it might be. And everybody, remember I got into a heated argument. I hope I don't hear. But I mentioned once that Hitler believed that everything he was doing was right. But he did, didn't he?
Yes.
The fact that he was as insane as he was doesn't take away from the fact that he thought he wasn't. That's the point. He was, in his mind, everybody who acts in a certain way does so because they think they're right, no matter what how awful they might act. So that's not some great revelation, just using him as an example. But I've done things in my life, I've said things to other people that as soon as they were out of my mouth, I wish I didn't say them. I wasn't a Hitler, but in the moment, I was pretty hurtful, wasn't I? But I acted that way not because of who I was. I acted that way because of what I had become, which wasn't and isn't me. And that's true for all of us. That's what the Buddha is teaching us. He just related this whole aspect of mindfulness to the Four Noble Truths. When we can understand there is suffering. It's not I'm suffering. It's that as a consequence of having a human life, the Buddha teaches and it states, an awakened human being states, it's going to hurt sometimes. It's going to be disappointing. He didn't say it's going to hurt sometimes. It's going to be disappointing. And then, so go do this. Go down to Baskin Robbins. Do they still have Baskin Robbins, by the way?
Yeah.
Go to Baskin Robbins and make yourself feel good or get a shot of whiskey or whatever it might be. He just said, every now and then it's going to hurt. Stop taking things personally. It won't matter. Stop craving for or clinging to anything be different than it is. Pretty simple. You inspired a couple of good talks this morning. Thank you. Becky, good to see you.
Good to be here, John. I really don't have much to add. This sutta is so remarkable because everything is in there, and I just feel like I should study it more and more and more. And the simplicity, again, as everybody said, it just smacks you in the face because it's so smart of the Buddha to be so detailed, and you know this and this and this and this, because the detail makes all of a sudden makes you leap to, wow, this is the big picture. Yeah. He's teaching, he's showing us the trees, and then all of a sudden you see the forest.
Yeah.
You're just like, it's just the same thing.
Yeah.
He's just trying to make us realize that it's possible to do it. But you just have to keep, you just have to keep practicing the Dhamma to do it.
Yeah.
And you will get these little little hints along the way that it's working, which is wonderful. It's which keeps you going.
Yeah, and even that isn't left to question, is it? The Buddha says this is what you look for. We don't have to take anything on faith, including is it working?
Right.
Look for this and you'll see it.
You can feel it working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It's just remarkable.
And
in that
it's
way. And
very personal too, because you know, if other people around you don't notice that you're different, you just feel different.
Yeah. I mean, some people may or may not. But
some people may or may not.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like you just feel, you know, calmer and you don't get so many of those.
Yeah, and again, it's worth the price of admission just for that.
Is.
It just makes our lives better,
mm-hmm.
which is what it was supposed to. It was supposed to do
it.
The Buddha set out at 29 with the intention of, if it was possible, to understand suffering, and he figured it out,
mm-hmm.
and then he taught us all how to do the same thing, to do exactly what he did. This Thursday's talk from the Dhammapada was on the Arahant chapter. In fact, you might want to listen to it. But in that chapter, he describes in very unambiguous words what it means to awaken. And what it means to awaken is what he said here, develop the understanding of Four Noble Truths. Anybody can do it. Thank you. Kathy, good to see you.
The comments that I have is the simplicity. I love that. Yeah, you just let it all wash out of you.
Yeah.
Let go of all judgment. Being present. I just go through my life now and I think so many people about what percent of them are actually present.
Oh, yeah.
You know, while you're just, you know, you're talking to somebody and you can tell they're not there and you're like, why am I wasting my time even being here? And just people go through their life and they're not participating, and it's such a kind way to be, and he just, you know, like I was brought up Catholic, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but it was always, you know, if you don't do this, you know, like your comment, if you don't do this, bad things are going to happen. There's nothing bad ever happens with this, and it's just enlightening, you know, and he's just so patient, and how could somebody figure this out like 2,600 years ago? You know, I mean, everybody says that, but it just really strikes me. You know, these are just such new concepts to me, and I just find it, just a relief.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a nice way to live your life if you can accomplish it.
Yeah.
A student. Someday I hope to.
Well, you've developed a very skillful foundation,
mm-hmm.
in a very short time. You're describing the practice as you should describe it. So good for you. It is just that. I had that experience again when I first started practicing what the Buddha taught. Just like all the stuff that I was carrying away, including what I was carrying around, including what I was dragging to this temple and that teacher and this teacher, all fell away. Because now I understood what I'm looking at.
Yeah,
know?
I just
Yeah, for the first time in my life, I wasn't distracted by my own so-called Buddhist practice away, and that has informed the way I teach, away from what I most needed to understand. But that's exactly what the Buddha found out, too. Did you read the sutta? I think it's called the Adita Pariyasana Sutta, but maybe not, where the Buddha describes his own search, noble search for awakening.
No, I'm so new to this, John. Honestly, I've come 3 times and I listen to you, and you know, it's just.
That's it, and you've done so well. I'm really a good teacher.
You're a good teacher.
If you want to hang around, I'll show you exactly on the website, but it's on the front, on the home page. I think it's the second or third sutta down, Noble Search, the Buddha's Noble Search for the Noble Path. But it describes this process.
I like how, you know, just be aware of your emotions and just be aware of them.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let them control you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just, that is so good.
Yeah.
It's so kind.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
So kind.
It's kind to ourselves,
so,
and it's kind to everyone else.
Yes.
That otherwise would have to hear me moaning and groaning about how unfair my life is.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's a perfect example of how this Dhamma, in a very simple but profound way, can actually change what's occurring. I don't know if it ever will make that great of an impact, but
mm-hmm.
it's just that. It just works. It does what it's supposed to do. So let's keep doing it. So if you can spend, next week, next Saturday, we'll be talking about the Four Noble Truths. I think that's the next chapter. But look at the Seven Factors of Awakening again a few times this week, just to start incorporating that into your own mindfulness, to be aware of it. And then we'll go over the Four Noble Truths next week and continue. I may introduce a few other new suttas when we get to the impermanence and the not-self in a few weeks too. But is everybody, are you going through the course with us with the book, or are you just coming to class? And it's okay either one you're doing, I just curious.
No, I am. So last week I couldn't come, so I just listened to your talk.
Oh, okay.
Last week.
So you're keeping up with us?
I guess.
Okay. Well, it sounds like it. All right, let's finish as we always do. So you'll read the next chapter. I think it's week 3, chapter 3 on the Four Noble Truths.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll discuss that. So again, let's finish with metta as we always do. Oh, and our retreat's coming up, our May retreat. Registration is open. Info on the website and in the emails. If you would like a quad room, women only, or a single room, let me know rather quickly. The Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture. Take a few moments to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And again, the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Thank you, David. See you soon. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.